This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Levine Museum of the New South is currently showcasing an historic exhibit. LGBTQ Perspectives on Equality not only spotlights the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, queer community of Charlotte and continued efforts to reach what advocates call equality for all, but it also looks back into the city's gay history, the national history of the movement for understanding and equality, and tells the stories of average citizens who made that history. The exhibit is the most extensive look to date at this struggle and is in residence at the Levine Museum through January. And joining us to talk about all this is Janine Bryant, Vice President of Education and Programs for the Levine Museum of the New South. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Joshua Burford is Assistant Director of Sexual and Gender Diversity at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Tonda Taylor. She is the retired founder and executive director of Time Out Youth. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Mike.
Janine, this is, as I said, the first of its kind exhibit for Charlotte. Actually, it's four exhibits
four.
In one.
Mm-hmm.
And some have called it Bold for the South. Where did the idea for this come from?
The idea actually originated several years ago, and our staff was very interested in looking at civil rights through a longer-term lens and looking at the legacy of the many anniversaries that have happened over 50 and 60 years ago. And in our conversations, we realized that we weren't talking a lot about LGBTQ perspectives, and we had room to do that, but we didn't have the capacity to do that.
Hmm.
So to the scene comes Josh and UNCC's archive, and their archival project around LGBTQ collections of history allowed us a partnership that would help us leverage every resource we had.
You didn't have the capacity because you didn't have the database? Is that what you're saying?
We needed oral histories. Mm-hmm. We needed multiple legs on the ground to collect the stories that were representative of Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
We needed capacity resources in terms of financial resources to actually put on the actual exhibit. And at that time period, we really didn't have it. But when you have collaborative community partners, you get to leverage a whole other level of momentum.
And why does UNC Charlotte have this database of information?
Well, I think part of it is my own obsession with the lack of queer history that we have in the U.S. And also, when you look at LGBT history that we have now, that history is centered very specifically in sort of large urban centers. We have New York's history, we have Chicago's history, we have San Francisco's history, obviously, where we're lacking those same histories in the South. And so when I moved to Charlotte, actually just 2 years ago this week, the first thing I asked was, where is our local history being kept? And everyone said, I don't think that's a thing we can do in Charlotte. And I said, well, I don't think that's true. And so we immediately started pulling together lists of people and ideas and stories to see what we could find. And we found the most interesting things in a community that was hungry to have its history preserved and also to know what it was.
So I said in the opening that this is the most extensive exhibit of its kind in the South. I think I said that. If I didn't, I should have. Is it one of the most extensive collections or exhibits of its kind anywhere?
Well, I think that the display and the preservation of LGBT history in the South is really new. Like, there are LGBT history places. So the Stonewall Center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. There are collections in Atlanta. There's a small collection in Alabama, in Tuscaloosa. So at this level, to look at four exhibits, as you said, looking at the national, the regional, the local, and the statewide history is unique. Mm-hmm. And I think that I haven't seen an exhibit that is curated specifically through the lens of the South in all four aspects ever in a museum.
How do you go about curating something like this from scratch? It hasn't been traveling the country. It's a whole new idea. How do you approach it?
Humility and being welcoming to new ideas and untold narratives. And so when I talk about collaborative community partnership, it was really important for us to talk, as Josh is saying, we knew that we could get connected with the Stonewall Archives in Florida, but the Pauli Murray Project, another one of our partners, they didn't yet have the exhibit actually created.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of conversation around our space and how might we best collect their information so that when we co-curated that it would be presented in a way that was really true and authentic to them, but also reflected their abilities to put them together in 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
Were you at all worried that the board or staff or at all worried there'd be a protest to have that kind of focus? I mean, it just amazes me.
Well, that's going to be one of my questions to you, Tonda, because you've been at this for a very long time, and we've done a show on your personal journey, which involves being a Charlotte native, growing up in Myers Park, moving off to Greenwich Village earlier in your life, being there just prior to or after the Stonewall uprising. And then coming home to Charlotte to take care of a family member, and then remaining here and starting Time Out Youth later on, much later on. Did you ever think that you would live to see the day?
I thought I would never live to see the day of an exhibit like this in the South, much less in my hometown. No. You know, I've been to the Cherokee Indian Museum and the Holocaust, and I've envied the other minority groups that so proudly have their history. I never thought I would live to see ours. It's just marvelous.
You know, Janine said that this is part of the museum's effort to study and display examples of the civil rights struggle in this country. A lot of people don't see this as a civil rights struggle.
It's an interesting question, I think, because
I didn't ask a question, but you go ahead.
No, but I think you do, though, right? Like, I think that the question on the table, right, is how do we frame conversations around civil rights? Uh-huh. And so I think that we have to be really, really careful about how we use the language of civil rights. So trying to compare struggles is never productive,
right,
because all struggles are different. And so the struggles of African-American communities, the struggles of Hispanic-Latino communities are different. They are, because of the nature of the way in which they move through the universe. LGBT community is a mix of all of those communities. So we have African-American people, we have Christians and atheists, we have Hispanic-Latino, we have all sorts of people in the community. And so the idea of comparing the struggles gets really problematic. I think that there's no reason to compare them. What we want to do with the history is we want to see how similar the struggles are, how we're moving through our worlds, what we're changing, the questions that we're being asked, and then respecting that we don't have to be the same to deserve the same respects and the same access that other communities do.
And in reality, it's really about humanity. So when I'm speaking of civil rights, I really want us to have a conversation around civil and human rights.
Yeah.
And what does that look like? And baseline is about humanity.
Right.
And so the conversation, when I say we want to put on a spectrum of civil rights, is really a conversation around, you know, how do we respect each other's humanity and how do we view each other's humanity and our worthiness? And there's so many lessons from history that can teach us how to look to the future.
Again, Tonda, you've been at this for a long time. Is this the vocabulary that's been used in the movement for all these years, or is this a new way of thinking and a new way of talking about this?
I think it's a new way. When I went to see the exhibit, they have a number of things from the New York City exhibit, the Stonewall exhibit. And there was a little magazine called The Ladder. Well, I remember in the late 60s, living in Greenwich Village and working, and it took me weeks to get up the nerve to go to the newsstand to buy that little lesbian magazine because I knew the guy would assume I was one of them. I mean, the fear factor and the fact that it was a mental illness and, you know, designated as a mental illness.
And illegal.
That everyone was closeted for survival. I mean, it was a frightening and exciting time.
What did it feel like to walk up there and buy that magazine the first time?
I was just so desperate. I mean, I had read very little. I hadn't met gay people, lesbians especially. And every paperback you read, the lesbians would end up alcoholic. One would be dead. They'd kill their dog. I mean, it was the message you kept getting in movies and literature was, don't go near this lifestyle, this way of living, you know. So anyway, I went to get that little magazine. Finally, I had to, and it was marvelous. Marvelous writing. Jane Rule was one of the authors. Inspiring. And that gave me the courage to go to another group that's featured in the exhibit called the Daughters of Bilitis. Terrible name. I mean, the name was frightening. But I heard that there were lesbians at the meeting, and I needed to meet some. And my assumption was I'd be jumped on by, quote, butches, and it would be a horrible experience. I go into this meeting, and there are about 40 women there. Two of the first ones I see are two women sitting down in front of me, one dressed in a marvelous pantsuit, the other in very femme, beautiful dress. They were Vogue models, and they told all of us that many it isn't just the gay male models, that there are many lesbian models. And I thought, okay, this, we're everywhere. We are, all of us are here and we belong.
You know, listening to Tonda tell that story is exactly why I wanted to do this project. Because, I mean, it's hard not to listen to her and not feel inspired. But when you think about those pieces of our history, like the ways in which individual people have struggled and fought and overcome, and the fact that you were in New York at the time of Stonewall, that you had that experience, is exactly why we have Time Out Youth. Right? You went and you learned, and then you returned home, and you took the things that you learned and that drive to make sure that other people had space to create the space that's so successful now. Like, that is exactly, that's to answer your earlier question, that's why I did the project. So we have that story.
In putting together this project at the Levine, you held 5 community listening sessions prior to the opening to gather reaction to the project so that it could be incorporated into the presentation. Is that a common practice for the museum to do, to go out and see how people will react to an exhibit they're going to put on and then whether you incorporate it or not is immaterial, just to find out how people are going to react?
Yeah, that's a common practice for
Why?
Us. We really want the community to not only actually just to tell them about what we're doing, but it's important for us to know what they need in the exhibit. So we've been doing this for many, many years.
Who did you talk to in this case?
So these listening sessions were actually the most complicated that we've ever done, because people we needed to have groups that self-identified as LGBTQ. We needed to have groups that did not self-identify as LGBTQ, and we needed to have groups of mixed community members where we wouldn't ask about their identification.
And what did you learn from this?
Many themes emerged for us, particularly around just this notion of community, and we had to complicate the notion of community because there was, you know, you can talk about LGBT community, but it's actually very complicated and nuanced, and you can talk about those who do not self-identify as the LGBT community, which is also very complicated and nuanced, and so we realized that there were restrictions and tensions and how people even labeled themselves. So pretty early on, even using LGBTQ, people would often walk up to us and say, what does Q mean? And so we knew that, I mean, part of it, even as we said the title of our exhibit, we were already into the space of having a conversation and educating people just about terminology and how it's moved and shifted.
When you said, when you told them what Q means, mm-hmm. and it means queer,
right?
Isn't that like saying the N-word for some people?
It was, actually. And so even as we were having these initial conversations, people would say, stop, right there. In our first listening session, they said, stop. It was all people who self-identify as LGBTQ, and they were also of an older generation. Mm-hmm. And they were saying it made their flesh crawl for them to hear us say that.
Talk about that. Why has that been adopted by the LGBT community? Why has queer been, it's become this award? Why?
I don't fully know. And I'm of the older generation that I try not to use that word ever. I don't like it. I think it's a bravado, a showing that this word that used to be just so totally damning for all of us, now we can toss around like a Frisbee. And
well, is it comparable? You're an African American,
mm-hmm.
Janine. So is it comparable in that way to the N-word? African Americans can say it to each other, but
this is back to what Josh said originally. When you're in conversations around civil rights, it's actually not productive to try to do a comparison that way.
Okay.
Because I think that's going to complicate the levels of struggle that African Americans have gone through with that word, which is clearly derogatory term. I think the only thing that's common about them is that they're clearly derogatory terms, and people have tried to reappropriate them for their own use. Mm-hmm. So I do want to toss it to Josh because I know that he self-identifies as queer. So
I do self-identify as queer.
Then
yeah.
We'll stop right there and let you identify after the break, which we're going to take right now as we talk about LGBTQ perspectives on equality, the Levine Museum of the New South exhibit that runs through January. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University, helping professionals advance their careers with a graduate degree. Virtual info session this Thursday, registration at northeastern.edu. And Susan G. Komen Race for the Cure, Saturday, October 4th, Uptown Charlotte, supporting breast health, education, screenings, and research in the community. Registration and details at komencharlotte.org. Well, a recent series by the McClatchy newspaper chain, which includes, of course, the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, prove that even in a digital world, there are still some things newspapers do best. They published a series recently uncovering a range of fraudulent activities by construction companies working on federally funded projects. If you missed that series, we will delve into it with two of the reporters who worked on it tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, multiple terror plots from Syria have U.S. officials rethinking whether ISIS is the primary threat in the region, concerns over arming rebels, and how best to respond to extremist threats to the West.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about LGBTQ perspectives on equality. That is the name of the exhibit at the Levine Museum of the New South now through January 2015 with Tonda Taylor, retired founder and executive director of Time Out Youth. Janine Bryant is vice president for education and programs at the Levine Museum. And Joshua Burford is assistant director of sexual and gender diversity at UNC Charlotte, who helped put together this exhibit. And we were just talking about the word queer, which is the Q in LGBTQ, a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, queer. You self-identify, it was revealed just prior to the break, as queer.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I think for me, queer is, I mean, Tonda's right, it is provocative, but it's intentionally provocative. And so when we started calling ourselves queer, it was intentionally so that we could take back the power that word had been used against us for 50 years. And the people who started saying queer, I mean, ACT UP activists in New York who were HIV positive in the early 90s, they were, in fact, the most queer part of our culture because no one wanted them. The LGBT and gay and lesbian people didn't want them. Straight people didn't want them. And they were demanding the things they should have gotten, which was access to health care. And so for me, when I first came out, I self-identified as gay for a few years. And it made a lot of sense at the time. But I didn't understand how liberatory it was to identify as queer because – for me, in the 21st century, gay and lesbian have been around for so long that people feel like they know what those words mean, right? And so if I self-identify to someone as gay, then whatever they feel about the word gay, good or bad, now they feel that about me without my consent. And so the conversation is just over. So if it's lots of really good feelings about gay people, then we have a really good relationship. And if it's not, then we have a really crappy one. When I talk about being queer, what it means for me is that I've self-identified to you as theoretically not heterosexual. That's what I've told you. And so you are forced to ask me what queer means. And so it's doing its job. It's making you interrogate, for me, my politics, my sex life, my personal life, my professional life, which is all happening at the same time, that doesn't get to be parsed out into little tiny chunks in different particular spaces. And so I'm all of those things all the time. So I love it.
Do you find that people have difficulty understanding what you just said?
I don't think so, actually. I think that people are the reactions to the use of the word queer are, if we're talking generationally, my younger LGBTQ students almost predominantly identify as queer. Really? Like we did the self-assessment on campus mm-hmm. last year. We asked students to anonymously self-identify. And predominantly, like 85% of the students who identified as non-heterosexual identified as queer. Like, that's a big number.
We found that same thing in our listening sessions. It was a definite generational difference in how people self-identify. In fact,
where's the breakoff point?
We actually did an interactive event. It was about, I think it's about 35 to 40 is where you start to see people creating that wiggle room to that, where it starts going more to queer.
You know, the movement, the LGBTQ movement seems to be picking up incredible amounts of steam at a rapid pace. I mean, despite some of the roadblocks that have been put up against it, it just seems that it's moving as quickly or quicker than any social change that I can remember, including the civil rights movement. So why this exhibit here? Why this exhibit now? Is it because of that?
We really think that the LGBTQ movement has really looked to, and Josh, you can push back if you like, but we really think that they've looked to the civil rights movement as a model for how to create and generate change and momentum. So I think it's the learning and the legacy from 60 years of people. And it doesn't necessarily mean marches. I'm talking about coalition building and collaborating and being able to talk through difference and being okay with splits and division and still being able to work towards a common goal. I think all of those are lessons that you can learn from the civil rights movement long term. And I think that's, if you take those collective lessons, you have more power to affect right. change.
And again, Tana, you've been at this a very long time, and you've been at times probably a reluctant participant in it, but it seems like the movement was a stroll, almost a crawl, and now suddenly everybody's in their Ferraris doing 180 on the interstate. How do you explain the change?
Well, as you know, I stumbled across the morning after Stonewall. I was in the village and approaching the Sheridan Square area, and I saw police barricades, ropes, glass all over the place, broken high heels, and it was the sissy bar, we called it. The leather bars were two blocks over. These were the sissies that, the sissy bar. So I asked this guy, I said, "What happened?" And he said, "The homosexuals fought back." And I thought, my God, we have never fought back.
For people who don't know, they were fighting back against what?
The police had invaded their space,
their bar
mm-hmm. which was common then.
Because it was illegal, right?
There were a lot of things that were illegal about that space, yeah. Like mm-hmm. it was illegal to wear, quote, opposite gender clothing. It was illegal to dance with a same-sex partner. It was illegal to engage in consensual acts of sex between adults. So all that was illegal. But what pissed them off was that they had paid their money to the police to leave them alone. Like, that's what made them mad. Like, they had paid their money, which is what they were supposed to do every week. And it was a mob bar, right? It was owned by a mobster's nephew. And so they had paid their money. And they were super mad because they thought they were supposed to be left alone. And so and there was a lot of pushback in that moment because people were angry about that.
But within 1 week, literally, suddenly I heard the words gay. For the first time, I heard gay pride for the first time. There was a newspaper that started. I got to some of the first meetings of this first gay newspaper. But I think homosexual people, we could hide our identity, whereas, you know, most African Americans could not. We could hide, and most of us did and had for most of our lives. To me, what has caused our movement to just make incredible strides is the courage of each individual to come out. When the appeal to come out of the closet began to be a national mantra, I began to see enormous differences. If you could come out to your mother and father or your priest or your siblings or your friends or your class, the movement was on.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, this is Janine sort of hinting at my pushback about this, but I feel like I will concede the point that there's more visibility, but I don't know that I would agree that the movement is making like epic strides. I think that it's making epic strides for very particular kinds of gay and lesbian people. So,
but if the Supreme Court strikes down all these anti-marriage amendments and constitutional amendments and laws, would you still say that?
Yes, I absolutely would, because the marriage equality movement, although interesting and sort of easy to, you know, put a sticker on your car about, doesn't address the problems of trans people. It doesn't address the problems of health care and access, mm-hmm. safety, of going to work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't address the problems of LGBT homeless youth, which are through the roof in our culture. 40% of the total homeless population, LGBT identified youth, that's terrible.
And that's because they've been kicked out by their parents?
Yeah. Mostly, yes. And there's no infrastructure. I mean, the work that Time Out Youth does isn't just unique to Charlotte. It's unique to everywhere in the U.S. where there are no social services in place for these kids. And so marriage equality can't fix those problems because it doesn't know how, and it's not designed to fix that. So if,
you know, but if you have marriage equality, doesn't that then put this issue, don't people begin to blend into the fabric of society as a whole and become acceptable to the society as a whole, and therefore it would be unacceptable for parents to kick their kids out because they identify as LGBTQ?
To Tondo's point, though, I think that the people who blend are the ones who already have the ability to blend, right? So if you're a white cisgendered person who has lots of money and you're living in New York or Washington, D.C. or Chicago, then you can blend easily. Like, you don't need marriage equality to help you blend. But if you're a gender nonconforming youth, or you're a trans woman of color, or you're lots of other people in the community, there's no way that you can blend in. You just can't, because the society's not arranged that way. And marriage equality doesn't do anything to fix that problem.
But you have made progress, it seems to me, since 1948.
Certainly. I'll concede that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is when, I believe, the timeline begins in this exhibit with the Kinsey Report. There were sexual taboos. There were criminal laws against this behavior. Your exhibit points out that shortly after the Kinsey Report came out in 1948, which shed light on sexuality in general in America and revealed a considerable number of homosexuals, there was a quick backlash that followed from journalists and politicians, and they warned that gay people were part of the communist international movement. Now, saying communist in 1948 and 1955 was like saying terrorist today. Why was there that connection? Why was there such fear?
It's the Lavender Scare, right? That's what they called it. Like, they were convinced that if gay men and women were in the closet, then if someone found that piece of information out, they could be blackmailed. And so they had to ferret out all these people in the government.
But isn't that circular logic?
It's absolutely circular logic, because they were forcing people in the closet in the first place.
Right.
So theoretically, you let everybody out and everything's fine.
So was that fear... was it strictly societally based? Was it religiously based? Was it much like the reaction to the rest of the Kinsey Report, a negative reaction to revealing things that were private in a very buttoned-down world?
And part of it, I mean, it was that, yes. But it was also – there were gay men who were closeted in the government who had a vested interest in staying in the closet. Is it all right to out Joseph McCarthy? Like, has he been dead long enough where I can say that on the air? But like the rumors surrounding Joseph McCarthy's sexuality, Roy Cohn, Roy Cohn was actually out and gay, but like they were invested in making sure that they didn't get outed, because while they were in the closet, they had all this power. And so they were afraid too, because if again, to Tonda's point, if everyone can come out, then they would have to come out too and then lose all that space that they had made for themselves.
You know, one of the things that you talk about in the course of this exhibit is the and this is a pinpoint in history, but nonetheless, it was a big one here, the Charlotte Repertory Theater production of Angels in America, which I'm loath to talk about once again. but that production stirred up a controversy that led to national attention for Charlotte and for the theater company, and some say to the dissolution of Charlotte Rep, one of the leading regional theaters in the country at the time. Here you are just a few short years after that. It has not been a long time in the scheme of history. And the Levine Museum is putting on this exhibit, four-part exhibit, for the better part of a year. Mm-hmm. Now, while that play was going on, I had a Charlotte City Councilman come to me privately, off the air, wanting to talk about the fact that I had done two shows on it, one with Reverend Chambers, who was very much opposed to it, and one with the other side of the coin. And he said, I have read the play and I feel as though I have been irreparably damaged by reading the play. So please stop talking about this because you are irreparably damaging people. That's just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. What kind of pushback have you gotten?
We always get this question. In fact, this complicated chart that I have here is designed.
Let's go over that on the radio.
It's designed for us to be able to actually, as a staff, to be equipped to enter into conversations once people have emotional reactions. And some people are very fearful that they will indeed be irreparably. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Damaged. And so we already knew that just from some of the feedback that we received, that people were very cautious. And mostly, actually, it had to do a lot with children. And the notion that somehow if a child were to see the exhibit and be influenced by it, that somehow would change that child's reaction to their own sexuality, their own identity, because a lot of the work actually is around identity development. And so we did put notice to parents that we put notice in the front desk to make sure that we inform all people who come in with small children that they need to supervise their children around the exhibit. But the actual content of the exhibit basically is around history and around untold narratives.
And just the fact that you're doing it, just the fact that you have that big sign outside that says LGBTQ perspectives on equality. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think of, I've forgotten, when was Angels in America? I've forgotten
like
when it was. 89, 90, 92, somewhere.
In Charlotte, 1995.
95.
Because
okay.
The cast just, well, we.
They just did it.
And they did it. We actually went there to do the listening session.
Okay. 1995. And in reality, the protests around that show were tiny. But the reaction was enormous.
Absolutely.
And part of that was due to the fact that it got on the Today Show and with the Charlotte mayor and the guy from Charlotte Rep talking about the play. And somebody said something negative about Charlotte in the national media. Well, you don't do that.
Right.
And that just blew the whole thing way out of perspective. Meanwhile, the play is playing the sellout houses. Because if you try to ban something that's controversial, everybody wants to see it.
Right.
But you're not getting anything like that.
We're not.
What does that say about Charlotte? You've been here a long time, Tonda. What does that say?
I was just thinking with Angels in America, one of the fallouts immediately was that any youth going to a counselor connected with the schools, if sexual orientation was going to be the topic, they had to take their parents with them.
Yes. Mm.
A parent. I mean, it was just such, the negativity was immediate and targeted, especially at the schools and gay youth in the beginning. When I looked around at the reception
for this
opening of this exhibit and looked at the people there that I assume were connected with the museum itself and the board, 10 years ago, I can't imagine as early as 10 years ago that people connected with the museum and with the funding would have agreed to this. I mean, something marvelous has happened. These people looked like the ones for the last, 30 years that I had been having to come up against again and again.
But just as Tonda says there's something marvelous that has happened, there has got to be an equal number of people, or at least a significant number of people, who would say this is a terrible thing that's happened, that the fact that you would devote space and time to this issue. You've heard nothing from them?
We have heard from them in terms of radio silence. because I think our go-to response to that is to welcome them inside the exhibit to actually see the exhibit.
Well, actually, I read that you have one fellow.
We did.
Who has come to the front door protesting on
yes.
several occasions.
Mm-hmm.
You've invited him inside, and he's never
actually crossed our threshold.
Why not? What's he say?
He nods his head at us when we invite him in, and then he walks on down to Imagine, and I guess protest small children. we've invited him in several times, and he's yet to cross our threshold, so...
Okay.
And that will continue to be our response. I mean, to anyone. I think once you actually see the exhibit, because I think that's part of the issue is that the marvelous thing that has happened is I think each time you have a conversation around something that has the potential to be controversial, I think you're opening up a space for dialogue and you're disrupting some of the narrative because you're opening that window and a space to change. But if you never have the conversation, then you don't open the window.
Most people think that this all began with Stonewall because that's the moment in time when gay people fought back, and the movement is dated from then. But you actually begin the exhibit just after World War II. Why? What was happening after World War II? Was there some kind of change in the atmosphere at that point?
So much happens after the Second World War. I teach like 2 15-week courses on this, so it's hard to sum it up for you. But the people came back from the Second World War, groups of gay men and lesbians, and wanted to be together. And so that impulse to pull together and to create community is what starts the movement in the 50s.
We'll stop there. We'll come back with more of this conversation about LGBTQ perspectives on equality. That's the exhibit in residence at the Levine Museum of the New South through January. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the University City Taste of the Charlotte Chambers University City Chapter. Thursday from 5:30 to 8 at the Shops at University Place. Tickets available at the University City YMCA. And WTVI presenting American Graduate Day, a telethon of programs that highlight groups of individuals who help promote graduation rates, September 27th, beginning at 11 a.m. Details at pbscharlotte.org. Multiple terror plots from Syria have U.S. officials rethinking whether ISIS is the primary threat in the region. And coming up in 20 minutes to 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Diane and her guests will talk about concerns over arming Syrian rebels and how best to respond to extremist threats to the West. That's coming up in 20 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
In the last several years, there's been an explosion of interest in craft beer and microbreweries in the Queen City and around the country. Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins will record a special show about the history and growth of Charlotte's beer scene at Old Mecklenburg Brewery this Thursday night. The recording is at 6:30, but Mike and the WFAE staff will be there from 5 to 8. So stop by and join us. Details at WFAE.org and click on events.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Janine Bryant, Vice President of Education and Programs for the Levine Museum of the New South, about the LGBTQ Perspectives on Equality exhibit that runs through January 2015 at the museum. Also with us, Joshua Burford, who helped put together this exhibit. He's the Assistant Director of Sexual and Gender Diversity at UNC Charlotte, and Tonda Taylor, the retired founder and Executive Director of Time Out Youth. You wanted to say, Tonda, that despite the impression that this movement is gaining speed rapidly and people are coming out of the closet and the issue is out of the closet. It's in the programs on television with gay characters that no one even bats an eye at anymore. It is not true that young people are having an easier time of it.
It is not true. They're still having a tremendously challenging time. And the incidence of gay and lesbian and bi and trans youth who are homeless across the United States are just staggering. I know Atlanta has done a recent study, and they figure that every night in Atlanta, there are at least 750 gay youth spending the night out on the streets. Mm. And in Charlotte, many of the youth choose not to go to the shelters because they're not safe, especially for the trans youth, but they're not safe in general. So Time Out Youth is struggling to meet an increasing need. I mean, from the very beginning, Time Out was about 2 months old back in 1991. We began having phone calls from kids saying that they had run or they had been kicked out. And our mission and the mission of Time Out still is to help prevent these kids from heading for the big cities, to get on the bus, to end up just in survival mode in the really large cities. So volunteers and people to help with housing for the Time Out Youth here in Charlotte is very, very serious and needed. So people should contact Time Out Youth.
Okay. And yet, despite the fact that the world is not getting easier for these kids, Joshua, you say that there's been a growth of students who identify as queer, and now we're going to get into a real nitty-gritty here, okay, queer and non-binary, a greater percentage than ever before at UNC Charlotte. Is that because more people are willing to openly and publicly acknowledge these things about themselves as society changes? And what do you mean by non-binary?
So I think that my students are identifying as queer and non-binary because they have, for the very first time potentially, they have access to an online community that is allowing them to explore their identities much, much earlier. And so it isn't just like two labels anymore, right? The community acronym now has 12 letters in it. And so the 12-letter community—
What is it?
LGBTTQQINAAE.
I just wanted to see if you could do it.
Oh, yeah, I can absolutely do it. Any minute of every day.
And what does that mean?
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsex, queer, questioning, intersex, Native American, two-spirit, asexual allies, and everyone we've forgotten to include. Staggering, right?
Yeah.
And we've gone to this we call it the alphabet soup in the community. Like, we've gone to the alphabet soup like just since 2001. Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people listening. Open-minded people, seriously, who are okay with this, who are just trying to be respectful and understanding.
Awesome.
And they, I would think that they're having trouble with what you just said. What is it with all these? It's just a sliding scale is what you're saying.
Well, I think what it is that what we said early on was that the community was really diverse, and so we were going to make room for people. And so as soon as we said that, and as soon as we gave people a vehicle, so the internet, although not everyone has the internet, I can see that it's a class-based thing, but as soon as we said you have the room to identify yourself, then people started to identify themselves, especially when it came to identities that were under constant duress. And so to go back to your point about non-binary, right? So non-binary identified people reject the notion that there is only male and female options for identification, that there are, in fact, all these ways that you can be a human being.
And, in fact, I was going to ask you, Janine, how you talk about this in the exhibit, and that's one part of the exhibit, if I'm not mistaken, and that would be the part with – I can't think of her name.
Well, actually, it's woven all through, but Pauli Murray Project is probably the most –
Pauli Murray Project. Yeah, talk about Pauli Murray.
So Pauli Murray, if our listeners are not familiar with her, is a dynamic, really dynamic leader. And that the way in which Pauli Murray identified was complicated for her time period. So by 1937, she had already rejected her initial name and changed it to Pauli. Exactly in that she was gender nonconforming.
She grew up in Durham in the 1930s, 40s. Did not identify as female gradually, correct?
So if you look at the second part of the title of the exhibit, Imp, Crusader, Priest, and Dude, those are actually the labels that she placed on her own pictures, and she dressed in ways that would definitely have stressed and created tension for people in 1937. Now, she is identified as the first female African-American Episcopal priest. That's already pushing some boundaries.
Right.
But she was really, in terms of like intersectionality, which is another thing we heard in listening sessions, in terms of being able to put all your pieces together and be able to claim all parts of your identity, she really exemplifies that. And so we were really grateful to partner with them on that project.
Yeah, one of the things that you find in this exhibit is you find that you think you know a lot, and then you really don't. I never heard of her before, and she was an extraordinary person who led an extraordinary life,
right,
given the times and the conditions that she faced in the world. First of all, being an African American, second, being a woman, thirdly, being whatever she identified as sexually and in terms of her gender orientation, and that's one of the things I think you also get into here is this whole. Gender orientation, sexual orientation, and there's more. It's like four different things. I can't even remember what they are. Bring them up. It's mind-boggling.
This is exactly what we wanted to happen out of this exhibit, right? The idea that we have to get down into the really complicated pieces. And here's what I think is the most interesting. I don't think that straight identity is simple. I don't think male is simple. I don't think female is simple, but we want them to be simple, right? Like, we want them to be these easy definitions that we can download. I think that everyone goes through their life in a really complicated individual way. It's not just gay and lesbian people that have complicated sexual histories or gender identities, right? It's not just trans folk who have that.
Let me ask a stupid question.
Please.
For centuries, it was simple. You were a man, you were a woman.
Oh, I don't know about that.
See, I don't either.
Yeah. At least on the surface. Society believed that, okay? And now suddenly we have 10,000 choices of cell phones, 10,000 choices of computers and refrigerators and cars and television programs to watch and radio shows to listen to and how to self-identify.
Yeah. And that's really liberating, right? Like, everyone always says, well, when are we just going to have one word? When are we just going to be people? I don't subscribe to that notion. Like, I think we need more. I think that to Janine and I's, you know, constant frustration about working on these projects together, it's the complications that matter.
So if there are all these ways to self-identify, what you're saying, I'm going to put words in your mouth.
Okay.
What you're saying is it's okay to identify wherever on the spectrum that you want to be and you'd like for society to get there with you.
Yes, we'd like them to get on board.
You also have to
It doesn't matter, or because there shouldn't be any fear about it.
I think it matters. I mean, I don't, it's not that it doesn't matter. It's just that what we do now is we place value, right, on the identities that matter. So, like, white heterosexual men really matter in our culture, right? They're not bad people, but they really matter. And so what we have to do is we have to sit down and really deconstruct why things matter and why other things don't. And so every time you push against that notion of the easy self-identification, we make things better for everybody. Mm. It complicates the lives of all of us in a really good way.
Tonda, I'm sorry.
Well, I think that gender and human sexuality, we have only begun to get an understanding. And we don't even have a language. I mean, the transgender community has had to create a new language because it wasn't in the dictionary. And this is just beginning. I think when I think of my great nieces and the choices they will have in terms of finding a partner, my gosh, it's going to be a smorgasbord of unbelievable diversity.
Yeah.
Compared to when I was growing up.
And although you say it's just beginning, one of the things that this exhibit explores is a timeline, a national timeline for the movement and a local timeline. Starting in the 1940s, there was a bar culture, even in the 1940s, places where gay people could go to be with other gay people, mm-hmm. and associate with people like themselves in a safe social environment. And there were places exactly like that. There were places in Charlotte that accomplished that. And I'm wondering if people knew it. For instance, we are sitting across the street from one of those places right now. Mm-hmm. And it was the Hornet's Nest at the Barringer Hotel at 8th and North Tryon.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting sitting across the street.
Right in the window.
Yeah.
So talk to me about that place. Did people know? Did the general public know?
I think the people who needed to know were the people who knew, right? So it was a way to organize community. It was a way to...
Well, how did the people who needed to know?
It was word of mouth, right? So you get to Tonda's point, right? You walk into a room thinking you're going to meet four or five lesbians. You walk in, there's 40 people. Right? Those 40 people got into that space because the community felt really small. So it was sort of like a complicated game of telephone, right? And so someone said, you know what? This space is being underutilized on this particular day of the week. We should go there and then take over that space. And then they did.
So it's the earliest takeover.
And the earliest takeover that we found. Uh-huh. I don't know if it's the earliest takeover in our history, but it's the one we found.
And there were other places in the 40s and the 50s before Scorpio, which was the first gay bar.
The oldest, yeah.
There was a place called Olean's that you talk about.
Yeah.
What was significant about that
place? Olean's was a really interesting space, partially because it was one of the first places where trans women were able to go and be safe in those spaces. And so Olean's, they had this sort of welcoming environment that allowed trans women, one of the very first places they could be and be themselves and express themselves the way they identified without fear. And so Olean's became this amazing place that was constructed specifically to create more community. And it lasted a long time. I mean, Olean's legacy continues now.
Where was that? When it closed, where wasn't it off South Boulevard?
I was in New York, and I was going to bars in the beginning. And you always had to worry about a police raid. They were smoky, and they were, I felt like sleaze. They were hidden. They were dark. You usually went down some steps.
Not in good parts of town.
No.
Not usually.
And there was nothing to be proud of being there. You felt it was a degrading feeling.
Yeah.
So from what I hear about Olean's and some of the others, they were probably more fun here, but very, very important to be hidden.
Well, and I think to the very first question that you asked all the way at the beginning of the show, like, this is the reason why collecting the history is so important. It's because we had a really complicated community in the 20s and the 40s. We had a complicated community in the 1870s.
Wow.
But we don't have access to that, right? Because we lost connections to our histories in the 80s struggling with HIV/AIDS crisis when the community was being devastated. And so going back, we are rediscovering how complex our community was. Even more complex in some cases than it was now, multiracial, multi-identities, multi-gendered, and rediscovering that history is what empowers us to do better in the present.
Absolutely. The American Indians had transgender people that were celebrated. They were considered to be gifted
century.
And wise.
Let me share some things that have come in on Facebook and email and Twitter while we've been talking. Jim on Facebook, thank you for the terrific exhibit at the Levin Museum of the New South. It's great to have LGBTQ history presented, recognized, and celebrated. I'm glad we live in times when we can live unapologetically as LGBTQ folk. You think that's true?
Absolutely, I think that's true, yeah.
Josh on Twitter, is there a qualitative difference of the queer in LGBTQ? What terms are best for straight people to use respectfully?
That's a great question.
Good question.
That's a great question. And we definitely wanted people to think about that and think about their own narratives and conversation with that. And the best thing you can do is ask. And you can ask politely which pronoun people prefer and how they want to be self-identified. And just ask.
Okay. Shannon in Charlotte emails, during Joshua's explanation about his self-identification as queer rather than gay, he mentioned that most of his younger students self-identify as queer rather than gay, and I'd like to hear the panel's thoughts on this. If this has possibly been influenced by the "that's so gay" phrase that was running rampant in our school systems over the last decade, "that's so gay" meaning as a derogatory term. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think I alluded to this when Josh was speaking. Just really quickly, we found that generational difference as well. And so, especially for young people, including high school age students, they would only self-identify as queer. They refused both gay and lesbian or bi.
Yeah. I don't know if it has to do specifically with that, the use of that phrase. I think what it does signify, wow, that was a really tough word for me. What it signifies for me is a shift in what the students are demanding, right? They are demanding resources now because they're getting organized. And so they won't be limited by other people's identities. They're going to demand they get their own.
Debbie and Charlotte, I'm wondering if the numerous faith communities who are so supportive of LGBT people and have taken public stands like Myers Park Baptist have influenced our city's openness.
Tremendously. Absolutely.
Okay. You know, it's interesting. While we have the marriage amendment in the Constitution here, and we have Robert Pittenger recently saying that one of the freedoms we enjoy as Americans is for private employers to have the freedom to discriminate against employees based on their sexual orientation, and he said that it's a matter of private property and the free market, that government intervention is not the best solution for matters of the heart, and there have been letters to the editor pro and con that statement ever since he made that statement. Despite that, the Rainbow Times, a Massachusetts gay publication, has named Charlotte as the 7th of 7 places for a gay-friendly fall getaway that would be easy on the wallet.
Nice.
The cities on the list include Puerto Vallarta, Finger Lakes, New York, Washington, D.C., the state of Vermont, the state of West Virginia, which I find very puzzling, and Palm Springs, California. They cite the recent Gay Pride Festival here, one of the largest in the Southeast, the Charlotte Royals rugby team, which is a gay rugby team, the Charlotte Roller Girls Derby team, as well as several other places and events. Does it surprise you we're on this list?
I'm more surprised that we're on a list with West Virginia. They don't have a state reputation for being super LGBT friendly. Whether or not they are, I have no idea.
Maybe they're just inexpensive.
Maybe so.
What would you say to Robert Pittenger about this?
I mean, I don't know. I think the idea of conditional prejudice is really interesting, right? And so we've decided that there are certain groups that it is politically expedient to no longer discriminate against, but it's still totally fine to discriminate against queer folks.
Very quickly, 10 seconds or less, do you think you're preaching to the choir with this exhibit? Are you reaching people who would not be reached otherwise?
I think we're reaching a lot of people, and I don't think we're preaching to the choir. And like I said, dialogue is most important.
That's Janine Bryant from the Levine Museum of the New South, Joshua Burford with UNC Charlotte, and Tonta Taylor, retired founder and executive director of Time Out Youth. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.